Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show.
Hollis Rich's career as a television writer and producer spans both half-hour comedy and hour drama, including Doogie Howser, M.D., Grace Under Fire, Picket Fences, and Party of Five. She co-created and co-executive produced State of Grace, a half-hour dramedy featuring Mae Whitman, Alia Shawkat, and Frances McDormand as the off-screen narrator. The critically acclaimed series earned 2 Humanitas nominations and 4 Jewish Image Awards for its humorous, authentic depiction of two girls of different faiths growing up in the 1960s South. Hollis attended UCLA's Graduate Film School Writers Program and is currently developing 2 half-hour comedies that feature a disabled lead. And Carol, I understand that Hollis has a special talent for comedy writing.
Yes, she does, Claire. And Hollis, Hollis is a brilliant writer, and we're so honored to have you with us. Thank you, Hollis.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're going to cover a lot today, but let's get started about your journey into the world of television writing and producing. And we'd like to know how you discovered your passion for comedy and what took you into this world of television writing and producing.
Well, not to go too far back, but I think that comedy sort of found me rather than my finding comedy. I grew up in a family that just had a great sense of humor. My mother's side of the family, the Brickman humor, was just always present during my youth, and both my parents were great storytellers. And as I was growing up, I sort of came of age in the MTM era of the Bob Newhart Show, Mary Tyler Moore, and even going back to Dick Van Dyke. And at a young age, I thought, wow, you know, those were hysterically funny, especially on Dick Van Dyke. I sort of remember as a younger kid thinking, wow, you know, I'd really like to work in that room with all those people. I kind of wanted to be Mary Tyler Moore and Dick Van Dyke. And then when the Mary Tyler Moore show came on, that just kind of clicked for me in a way. So I was always very interested in that. And I listened to a lot of comedians growing up. But moving forward, when I went to school, I ended up going to Berkeley, and I majored in psychology. But my last 2 years at Berkeley, I actually was in the theater department and was doing a lot of acting. And at that time, I thought, oh, I really want to act. I really didn't think about writing, although I had always written. And for some reason, I was supposed to go on to the clinical psychology program and get my degree and maybe go into research. And for some reason, I sort of forgot to apply. I like to say I forgot. Clearly, I was a little more conscious of it than that. And I went back down to Los Angeles where I grew up. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. And I started getting involved in the local comedy scene at that time in the late 70s. And I was doing a lot of improv, meeting a lot of people, and actually with a writing partner, I wrote one of the first HBO specials called Road to Yucca Luna, oddly enough, with Alan Thicke, if you remember who he is. And that sort of got me started on thinking, wow, I could actually do this. So I did apply to UCLA Film School in the graduate writing program, and I spent 3 years there, and I learned quite a lot. And also the best thing about film school was really connecting with people who had the same interests that I had, and that was a pretty amazing experience. But since I had gotten a late start, I was edging up on on turning 30, which, you know, felt incredibly old at that time. And I realized, you know, I was I was poor. I had literally no money. then I needed to make some money. And at that point, I knew that I could write comedy. So the last year for television, and the last year, because they did not teach television at that time in film school. It was considered very day class A. So what I did was I just watched a lot of half-hour TV for like a whole year and just kept watching. And by the time I sort of developed an ability to either predict the next line or, in my opinion, write a better line, I sat down and I wrote two sample scripts, one for the Bob Newhart show at that time, and then something called Kate and Allie, and I gave them, I did have an agent that I had gotten off of a screenplay that I wrote at UCLA that actually was sort of a precursor to State of Grace later, because it took place in the 60s, and it was about my older sister and myself in the 60s. And so I had an agent, and I sent her, I gave her these two samples, and happily enough, I started getting calls and going out on calls. People liked it. It hit. And I got my first job on Fame LA. And I think what was happening at that time, too, is I was probably one of a very small number of women that could write hard comedy, and so that really helped propel my career forward. I was generally, in fact, for a long time I was the only woman in the room, which was its own very interesting experience. That just sort of brought me to, I just started to work. I just started getting jobs, and so I didn't have a really hard break-in period, to be honest. That was sort of
Well, let's go back to what was it like in a room? How many men would there be normally with you?
Well, a lot more than me. It would be me and, you know, the executive producer. All the people in charge were men. There were no women, no executive producers or producers or anyone above me that was a woman. I had literally no role models at that time. So I was the only woman, and, you know, some rooms were fine. I did 2 years on a show called Throb with Cy Rosen, who actually was a writer from the MTM school. He had written on the Bob Newhart show, and I consider him really my mentor. He really did teach me how to write hard comedy and would just say, you know, Hollis, that's not technically a joke, and he really just guided me through. I learned on the job. I really did learn on the job. I had a talent, but I worked at it. I did have a gift, that's for sure. But I worked at it very hard, and those were very exciting years, actually. Yes, being alone in a room with men, there were other shows that were not so great. For example, Grace Under Fire, not a pleasant room, me and 10 guys, some of whom were, you know, a little bitter. A little this, a little that, and we're not accustomed to having a woman in the room. I don't know what I can say on the airwaves there, but wasn't pleasant.
It wasn't pleasant.
It was. You know, I felt hazed all the time, frequently hazed. I really don't think they went home and spoke to their wives, you know, in the same way they were, you know, throwing things around in the room. Which was amazing, too, because Grace Under Fire was a show about a woman, and, I don't know, there are a lot of stories I don't feel particularly comfortable telling at this moment. But I survived. It was not easy.
Yes, well, the most important thing is UCLA and all the classes you took. You had the background, and growing up in a family of storytellers, all that was to your benefit.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing that was interesting, and I don't know why this was, and just me, was I felt very confident about what I did. I felt confident. And as I started to work, in half-hour TV at that time, which was multi-camera, you got immediate results. You had two audiences on a Friday, and if they laughed at your jokes, you knew they worked. And so I began to understand that I had the ability to know which jokes people would respond to. So I felt very, very confident. Of course, all of this worked against me with my male colleagues. They didn't seem to like that. It was hard for them to accept a woman who was not only just as good as them, but also could be better. And I learned that.
Yeah.
And that was the most difficult part of the job, frankly, was that negotiating those relationships, those creative and professional relationships at that time. It did get easier. It really did get easier. But at that time,
yeah,
I just sort of white-knuckled.
That was really hard. I know I was in the film industry in the 70s,
right.
And I never used my name, Carol. I used my initials. Because they were so difficult as a woman in business. It's better they think you're a man, because in those days we wrote letters, so it was quite all right. They didn't see you until they met you, and that usually was when you closed the deal. So it always worked.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I used my name Hollis on purpose, and many people did think it was a man. And when I showed up and was a woman, they were always a little surprised. And it did work for me. And I would get letters. You know, everybody on the show is, it's like doesn't know anything about men, and this is anti-men, except for that one writer, Hollis Rich. He really gets it. And I was like, oh, my God. I kept that letter for so long on my fridge. I don't know what happened to it, but it was there for, a long time.
Oh, that is terrific. Yeah. Well, let's get into the time when you co-created and co-executive produced State of Grace. What were some of the challenges and the highlights of working on that project?
Well, I think one of the challenges was there were no coming, even at that in that era, and that was 1999 when we started, Brenda Lilly and I, who co-created and co-executive produced, started pitching it around, and there were no coming-of-age stories for girls, unbelievably. That was the time of Wonder Years, and we were compared to Wonder Years, although that was not, we didn't go out to say, oh, we're going to do another Wonder Years. What happened was that we basically wanted to talk about our youth growing up in the 60s. Strangely enough, Columbine had just happened, and we wanted to know what kids were growing up with today and how it was different and what had changed. And we wanted to really examine that. And so, but one of the challenges was, does it have to be girls? We literally heard that in a meeting. We basically brought our families together. Brenda grew up Catholic in the South, and I grew up in Chicago and in California in a multi-generational Jewish family. We both wanted to depict our families, so we basically took my family and moved it to the South. And we would get notes in development meetings. Does she have to be Jewish? Like, well, kind of. Yeah, it's sort of about tolerance and, all the themes that were swirling around in the 60s. And we kind of, we kind of want to keep it that way. So that was amazing when you think even at that time, as we were entering, the 2000s, that those were the attitudes that were still not unusual. And yet we did succeed, and we got on a little network that was originally Fox Family and became ABC Family. And other than that, the challenges once we got into production were, frankly, the highlights are better than the challenges. The main challenges are things that happen. It was a low-budget show, so it was money and being able to depict the 60s authentically on a budget and how to do that. And we had just a great production team, and we just had a marvelous cast. We were so lucky to get Mae Whitman and Ali Ashokat as the young girls, And then, of course, we landed Frances McDormand, who had just come off winning an Oscar for Fargo, unbelievably wanted to do our little show on a network that nobody had heard of, really, because she loved the script. She thought it was funny and wanted to do it. And she was our off-screen narrator and, of course, wonderful to work with and added so much to that show. And then in our as we went into our second season, the biggest challenge was just keeping our show on the air when ABC Family changed management. And the people that came in, the person that came in, because she had no ownership of our show, was basically looking to get it off the air and moved it around. And basically that's how a show that was really a hit with audiences and had won prizes and was a critical success got canned after two seasons, which is really unfortunate.
Because she moved it from the time slot. It was in a good time slot, right?
Yes. It was, I think it was 8 o'clock on Mondays or Wednesdays, I can't remember, but it was in a time slot that everybody knew. It wasn't even that it was a good time slot, it was a consistent time slot. So I remember my parents called me and said, you know, we don't even know where to see the show anymore. Were you canceled? So what she did systematically was to move the show all over the place, and then we did lose ratings. And then she pointed to the loss of ratings, and they were able to cancel it. But actually, people in the industry knew that that had happened, and one person in particular at The Hollywood Reporter, I can't remember her name right now, actually wrote about that. But it didn't do, it really did not, we weren't able to place the show anywhere else, we weren't able to place it on ABC. Anyway, that was the way things sometimes end, like that, and that was really just too bad. The wonderful thing about that show is we had a great set. The two girls became lifelong friends. People became lifelong friends on that show, and we had a great experience, and it really is the highlight of my television career. I don't expect to sort of duplicate that again. I'm still looking forward to doing other shows, but I think that was sort of the highlight for me.
Well, I can imagine. It must have been a great show to write because you lived it, you felt it. And I would think that the costumes, you know, the bell-bottom trousers, yeah, the short skirts, the hip-high boots, I mean, all of those 70s things would really add to a show.
Oh, yeah, that was incredibly fun. And again, our costumer, Anne, oh, I'm forgetting her last name, but it was just wonderful. The things that our production team did with not a really high budget, I think we were like at $650,000 an episode, which was not much. It was a film show. Everyone came together, and the feeling is that when you have something good, you have a good script, and everybody's there for the right reasons, it really, there's an alchemy that happens that I'd never actually seen on any of the other shows I'd worked on, that really comes together to create, it becomes something much bigger than what Brenda and I sat down and wrote in our little office. And, you know, our vision, it became much bigger. And that was an incredibly exciting experience, quite honestly.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, let's get into writing comedy. So,
sure.
Tell us why that comedy and pathos go together. How can using these two things make your writing more powerful?
Well, my feeling about writing is there are different styles of writing. I like to combine comedy and pathos because my whole thing is to replicate life as closely as possible, because I feel that is how audiences connect with character and story. So it really is replicating how life feels, which is comedy and pathos do go together. I think we all know times where things are really awful, and then somebody can make a joke or say something funny, and you can be laughing really hard. It's a fine line, really. And it really is that tension between the two in a scene, tonally throughout a series, that I feel makes it all more powerful. And because you were dealing with real issues, and to have comedy in that context, I think, I believe, hits a chord with audiences and makes the comedy actually funnier, because it basically recreates an emotional experience for audience, which is what I believe you're going for. You want to recreate this emotional experience. You want to bring them into this kind of dream state. It's almost hypnotic, and you don't want anything to throw it off, where people sort of come out of that state. So, and in a comedy, when you have pathos, it also can be unexpected, and if it's done right, it doesn't just feel clunky like a, you know, like a sentimental, overly sweet moment. It feels real, and yet the surprise of both keeps the audience alert and interested also. I think that's part of it. It's always keeping the audience interested and not making your portrayals predictable or your scenes predictable.
Right. Well, what has inspired you to focus on developing the two half-hour comedies featuring a disabled lead, and what challenges or opportunities do you see in representing disability in the mainstream media?
Well, what inspired me to focus on two half-hour comedies featuring a disabled lead essentially is one guy, and his name is Jim Lebrecht, who did Crip Camp, and this was way before he did Crip Camp. But I am based in the Bay Area at the moment, and I met Jim. I had actually was working on a documentary with some friends of mine, and I was helping put the music in, and I met Jim. He was the sound guy on that, and the sound creator, and he was interested in doing, and he's disabled, he's a wheelchair user, and he was interested in comedy, doing a comedy. He knew I was a comedy writer, and doing a comedy that featured a disabled lead, And we started to have conversations. He's a great guy. I met him. I met his wife. And we started to have these conversations. At first, I was actually reluctant, and I said, well, you know, I don't know who's going to buy this and blah, blah, blah. But the more I got to know him and his wife, and he took me to some comedy clubs, comedy nights featuring disabled people, where I was really surprised, because there was this kind of insider humor that happens that it was very exciting, actually. I thought, you know, this could work. This could work. So we just started to talk, and the first thing we developed was a show based on his life, although I turned him into a woman because it was just wanted to, and I think female leads are more popular right now, and that was one half hour, and we wrote a spec script for that, which we are still, we're developing in terms of people are connected, then they're not connected, you know, it's a whole process. And the other thing is that then we were offered a job to adapt a book called Good Kings, Bad Kings by Susan Nussbaum, which was a wonderful book she wrote about 10 years ago about a county facility for disabled teenagers. And it featured also a comedic disabled lead, which we developed into a half hour that focused on this woman who recently became disabled. She had a car accident, and she goes into this facility, and that we are getting a lot of traction with now. We allied with a production company, Echo Lake, and Mary Jane Skalski is our producer. She did The Station Agent and a bunch of other things. She's a very well-respected independent producer. So we're with good people, and we're pitching it now this season as a half-hour comedy and getting lots of positive reactions. The challenge is somebody pulling the trigger and greenlighting something that's never been done on television, which is to have a half-hour comedy with a disabled lead. It just never happened. It's a big step. And, you know, it's just another barrier to break. Like as with State of Grace, there were no coming-of-age stories with girls. And in this case, I think I was challenged by the idea of, I've always wanted to see in my work to put people on the screen that are not usually seen on the screen and not in stereotypes, and to portray them realistically and comedically, again, because I think it's important. I think people are a little afraid of seeing disabled people on the screen because, honestly, you can wake up one morning. You can't wake up one morning and be a member of a minority group or et cetera, et cetera. But you could wake up or go outside and become disabled, and everyone can become disabled. And, frankly, there are a lot more disabled people out there than most people realize. It's been estimated 1 in 4 people have a disability. It's a large audience.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot of people.
It is a lot of
people.
But,
you know,
and as you get older, that increases, as we know.
Right. Well, will the comedy be around their disability in any way? Does that come into the screen? Do you talk about that?
Well, it does. But it really... We tend to, that's why working with Jim is so wonderful, because he has a total insight into that community. He is a, not just a sound designer now, but is also a major advocate and activist for the disabled community. And he's very visible now as that. And he is what makes the show authentic. And my point of view is coming in and just depicting these people as just people who happen to be disabled, but, you know, folding in. Of course, some things will be, but we're not going to do a lot of, you know, like disability jokes, but the humor is about their lives. And I don't do jokes too much, but it really is character humor and character-based humor and that comes out of the stories and just their point of view, which is people trying to make it in this facility, in this institution that is failing them, and yet they're working together as a community. And that's very powerful, and it's also very funny. If you think of the show quite a while ago of the MASH unit and the comedy in the MASH unit, which
yes.
was against, it's not, they're not in a war, but they are sort of, you know, they don't quite fit in society yet. We're not ready for disabled people yet. We're getting there. We really have made great strides, which is why I'm very hopeful. We're all hopeful that this show will get on the air soon or something like it, but we'd like it to be our show, of course. But, you know, that was against the Korean War, and here it was one of the funniest shows on television.
Yeah.
So it's the characters and the people and how they react to their situation where the humor really comes out of, I think.
Right. That was a great show. Right. Well, I think it's wonderful because in documentaries, I'm supporting a filmmaker who is making a story about a teacher who caught some kind of a virus, and she had to have all four, her arms and legs all amputated. So it's a very sad film in many ways, but she is determined, and it's so empowering to watch her determination. And she put her seatbelt on in one scene, and it was, ta-da, see, I did that.
Right.
But I went back to the filmmaker and said, how did she do that? Because some days I can't get my seatbelt, and I have both arms, right? And you know how that is when you're, maybe you've got on a big coat or something, and can't get the thing to button. So she agreed with me after conversation that I'd like to see her starting to learn how to use that new arm and mm-hmm. how much push she had to do. How do you learn how to use something like that? Show that many times she failed before she succeeded. And we agreed that would be much more important for the audience to understand that it's only through tenacity and determination do these people, are they able to be to do something very simple sometimes?
Well, I think in both of the shows, we do show that. We do show sort of what the life is like, but we tend to focus more on the sense that these are people who are not just surviving, but thriving. And especially with the kids,
wonderful.
The spirited nature of these kids. And but we don't whitewash the reality of it. And there's some darker moments, especially in the adaptation, which we're calling Becoming Joe Madsen at the moment. But in that adaptation that happened in this institution, but it is against the backdrop. Again, it's the comedy and the pathos, which shows up most clearly in this adaptation. But certainly that is important. So we don't whitewash the realities of being disabled. However, our focus in a comedy is really they're thriving, not surviving, which really does reflect, frankly, according to Jim, most of the disabled community. You know, there's like any community, homogeneous. You know, it's not just one block of people. There is a range of disabilities and abilities. And it's a very powerful movement, and I do believe that it's coming into its own now, because I've known Jim for over 8 years. So
wow.
I've watched this develop, definitely. And
but
that's
thriving.
What pulled me in. I never would have been pulled into it, but I'm glad that I was, because at this stage in my life, I really only want to create television that has more of an immediate social impact that is useful. It's so difficult to get shows made that I don't want to do a show about a bunch of kids trying to break into show business.
right.
I mean, that's fun, and let other people do that, but that's not sort of where my head is at right now.
No, this would have an immediate impact, just like you're saying. And I really think that by describing it as thriving, not surviving, is something that would bring viewers to the screen. What's this all about? How can you, how can you have a major handicap and then thrive with it? That's a great thing for us to all learn.
Well, that was the idea of making. Originally, we were working on it as an hour show, but we sort of realized at a certain point that the shock of making it a half hour, which made me happier because I felt it would have more impact as a half hour comedy. Just frankly, the surprise element, as you were saying too, like wow, a half hour comedy with a disabled lead. What's that? What are we talking about here? And also, because a half hour might be easier and more palatable for audiences to commit to rather than an hour. All these things are in our head as we try, as we're trying to sell this. People love this in the room. It really is taking a chance and worrying about audience. I do believe that audiences will come, but somebody has to be the first to break through. It was like Will and Grace. Somebody had to be the first to break through with a gay lead in a comedy. That was a big breakthrough, and it made a huge difference And we feel this is a kind of show that could just really make a huge difference way beyond just watching television and enjoying the entertainment.
Right. Oh, this is exciting. And this is what you're pitching, right?
That's the reason why I'm doing it, because I feel like it's beyond, it's bigger than me, which I always like. It's bigger than me. I do have my own little social agenda. I'm an entertainer first, but honestly, I'm very aware of what's happening in the world and have been for a long time, and I come from a family that has a history of, being stuck in countries that were falling apart and having a lot of issues. And I just, anything I can do to make that better, to make people more aware, kinder and gentler, and to accept other people is great for me. It makes me feel great. So,
well, that's perfect. Well, let's talk about your pitching your TV series, because I understand that you're having a lot of experience now with this new project. So what do you think are some of the top priorities in pitching?
Well, right now, what I was told by Mary Jane, who's out there pitching other projects too, because Echo Lake has a lot of projects in play, and she's right in there, is brevity is very important right now. So we're pitching something. Normally a show like this would be a 20-minute pitch for a half hour, and we have pared it down. It runs around 13 minutes, but it's called, we call it the 10-minute pitch. We've also sort of nicknamed it the producer's pitch, which is very bare bones. And at first I was like, oh, my God, how are we going to do this? But as we've moved through it, we have added a little thing, some things here and there, and sort of oomphed it out with some dialogue and definitely some humor. But basically, it is telling the producers, what the budget is, how it films, where are they going, what's going to happen, how do we get from A to B, who are the main characters. So it's really basics. It's very basic. But in doing that kind of pitch, also, you need to embellish, and especially with a comedy, have some humor in there, and just the way you actually convey the information should be in a humorous tone, which is what we've done. And we also find we get a lot of mileage out of the short synopsis of the pilot, which people really respond to, because we really make it very dynamic and include some dialogue and have some dramatic moments and some very funny moments. And people have really responded to that well. So that
sounds great. Now, are you doing this with the script or without?
Well, years ago, I probably could have done this and memorized the whole thing. Unfortunately, I could not memorize this now. I also, obviously, Jim and I pitch it together, so we have to divide. We divide it, so we absolutely have a script that we have practiced, and it's very tight. I tend to improvise a little, which is my want. Jim usually stays to the script because this is he's great at it. Was a little newer to him, but we do. But even and we're Zooming now. We're not in the room, so I tend to look up into the camera often and connect with with our buyers as much as possible. But I wish I could memorize the whole thing, honestly. But since I can't, and there doesn't seem to be a problem with that. It's really sort of the energy and committing to it that you put your ideas across, not so much that you have a little cheat sheet there in front of you.
Okay. Oh, that's really hard, I think, to do it on Zoom, because being in the same room, you can feel their energy and read so much from their body language. And all that is lost on Zoom. So that makes it even harder, I would think.
Yes, especially when they mute their microphones to be polite, and then you can't even hear them if they're laughing. So it is. That is a real challenge, and makes it even more important to try to connect with your buyers at the beginning of the pitch and after the pitch, because a lot does happen in the room, which is Zoom, but I'll call it in the room, besides the actual pitch. Which is setting the tone, setting a sort of conversational, relational, participatory tone with the buyers, and just connecting with them in the beginning about anything, just the weather, something silly that's happened. I even find sometimes that making a mistake in the pitch and then laughing about it is useful, because it shows that you're human and that you're not just sort of performing. And also trying to blur the line between talking to them and going into the pitch, rather than saying, okay, well, now we're going to give you this pitch. It's just like, okay, well, let me tell you a little bit more about this. And then you start into the pitch. So it's as if you're continuing the conversation, which is something that I really did learn this time around that I think is very useful and puts everyone at ease. So it's really just one long conversation, but in the middle, you and your partner are talking a lot, and then you continue talking to them afterwards for questions.
This is great, because this is what I think. I think it has to be part of your DNA. It's natural. You are the film. It's easy to talk about it because you've created it.
Yes. Yeah. It certainly gets easier the more you do it, too. I mean, everybody's a little nervous, but it's fine to say that you're nervous. It's important. They really want to see you being passionate. Being nervous does not bother them. You're not an actor. You're not going to be on stage. You're not going to be on camera acting this out. But they want to see your passion and commitment to it, which is important to convey. So you don't want to be too cool when you're pitching. You want to really commit to it. The practice. That's why practicing a pitch and having a script, I think, is incredibly important, unless you're one of those people that can just wing it, And frankly, I used to be able to do that, but I can't do that now. So practice, especially if you're working with a partner. You want to develop, and Jim and I have developed a great relationship where, there's chemistry there, and that they pick up on that. I mean, the other thing about pitching is what they're looking at, consciously or unconsciously, is, do I want to spend the next, 6 months to a year or more with these people? Like, do I like these people? Do I like hanging out with them? Which is easier to assess when you're literally in the room with them. That's why you have to try a little harder to create a conversational, relaxed atmosphere in the pitch, because that's a big part of it. They're not just committing to your show and your ideas. They're committing to you. Is this somebody I can work with? Is this somebody, if I have a suggestion, how do they react to it? Which is, again, my thoughts about having them participate in the pitch and contribute afterwards through questions, et cetera. And how do you react to that? You don't want to be negative about a reaction, but how do you take that and, incorporate it or embellish it and work with them? And so they feel, oh, wow, I can work with this person. We can have a creative conversation, and they're going to add something, and I'm going to add something. And that makes everyone feel good. I think that's very important.
That is so true, and you're one of the few filmmakers I've heard that realizes how important that is to engage the people you're pitching. Engage them, leave room for them to comment and be part of the creation. Add their comments. Well, you do work with people with consultations and sometimes help with their comedy scripts, right?
Yes.
That's a service you give. Well, could you just share with us how people can contact you?
Of course. So you can contact me at my professional email, which is my name, which is Hollis, H-O-L-L-I-S. And my last name is Rich, R-I-C-H. And then Wright, hollisrichwrite@gmail.com. So it's hollisrichwrite@gmail.com. And I'd be happy to talk to you if you're interested in having a coach, having me read a script, working on some specific area of screenwriting, television writing. I'd be happy to talk to you.
Great. So let's go back to this creating participation in the pitch and expand on that, because I know what you're doing is you want the buyer to participate. So how do you get to that point? It's something you write in your script, or give us some hints on how to do that.
Well, I think, it's an interesting tension, again, when you're talking about characters or this is subtle, I believe. Characters or what's going to happen in the season or what's happening in the next season. I know there is a trend, I think, to want to know 6 seasons out, and perhaps in hour shows with very complex plots, that's important. However, when pitching a half hour, comedic drama or dramatic comedy, which they're calling it now, I think it's important to know the basic through lines, but not to tie yourself down to too many details. They could do this and this. You know, they could go off for that trip, or maybe these two align together, and, you know, depending on how this happens. So I think that conveying that you absolutely have control and you know where to place these people, but also keeping things options open makes it interesting. And it's a tension. So you don't want to look as though you don't know what's happening in the next season, or you definitely, I think, want to have know where the season one ends. But if they ask about other seasons, to sort of create some possible storylines and even say, well, I feel like this is the strongest, but we could also do this, which also makes them realize that you're an idea machine and that you're open to input from them, if that makes any sense.
Yes, that's terrific. Yes, we could also do this. That's really important, right? Yeah, you're not locked in. You're flexible.
Right, like any audience, you know, when you sit down and you watch a movie or a television show, I want to feel that the person who did this show or this movie is in control. And you can usually, I can feel that in the first 10 minutes in the first act, like that, okay, I can relax now. They know what they're doing. And I think that's what the people in the room want to know, especially if you don't have a recent track record or you're new or you're coming back, you've done things. They want to know that you are still, that you're in control, that you know what you're doing. They can relax. You can do your part of this. You know, they'll do their part, which is giving you a lot of notes, some of which will be good and not all of them will be. But they can do their part, and they want to know that you can do your part. So you have to demonstrate that a little, I think, in these meetings. Again, this is all happens so quickly, but usually have at least a half hour in these meetings or 45 minutes.
Oh, that's good to know. Great. But how do you get the meetings? Is she setting those up for you, or do you do it yourself?
Well, it works differently. So in this project, Echo Lake and Mary Jane Skalski and her associate, Kyle, both basically do the groundwork. And because we're very lucky here because she's so respected and has been in the industry for a long time and people know her, she's able to get us really high-level meetings with good people who already know that what she brings in is good. So it really puts us in a great place, frankly. And Echo Lake is very respected, and so that is great. In terms of our other show, which is we have a pilot script, and we're not connected with any, at the moment, we're not connected with we're loosely connected with a production company, but so we're not actually moving as quickly on that at this time, and we're concentrating on the adaptation. But in that sense, then, we do have a manager who sets up meetings. Jim meets a lot of people in the business also, so it's a little tougher. It's much better. This is the idea of trying to connect with a production company that has some standing in the industry is really important. The other thing is, of course, people are probably aware of that they want networks and even other production companies want you to come in with as complete a group as possible. If we could get an actress, attached, which is difficult, that makes it even better. An actress that is well-known or a very well-known director or another producer to bring in another producer. So this is not always the case. But now, just because of the nature of the industry, it's like buying a house. If you want a turnkey house, when you buy a house, they kind of want a turnkey production. They want you to put everything in place. So that's sort of how the strategy is going now.
So then you really need some development funds to get an agent to find an actress and a director and things like that, don't you?
Well, at this point, it really is not so much development funds as needing to just connect people. Again, it's relationships and connections, but historically it's very hard to get actors connected to a project that isn't set up somewhere. So again, you're back to sort of a catch-22, which I remember when I was in film school. It's like, well, you can't get jobs until you get an agent. And how do you get an agent? Well, you have some jobs and, that sort of thing. I was fortunate, again, in film school, there was a screenwriter came to class and gave us one day at a seminar, gave us a whole list of agents that were looking for young writers, and I went down through the whole list and contacted all of them. And Nancy Moon was I can't remember the name of the agency at that moment. It was a smaller agency. Anyway, she took me on, so I did have an agent. It's tough. It is tough to do that. But again, trying to pitch first to a production rather than going directly to a network or streamer, approaching a production company that might be interested in the kind of work you're doing. And again, this is where you really want to pull out all your connections and anybody who knows anybody and just be stealth. Have no shame. It was very hard for me in the beginning to sort of promote myself. It still is a little difficult. But the fact is you must have no shame. You must approach everybody that you know and try when you're in that,
stage.
That's just the way it is.
That's exactly right. Total dedication. Focus is the key word here. Focus on what you want.
Yes, and just go for it because it really does pay off. And it is a tough business to get started in if you're not connected. And it still is a very tough business. And it's become much more about connections than it was when I was starting, I believe.
I think you're right. I love connections in the industry because by now you've got a lot of long-term friends, so do I, and that's one of the great things because we all seem to be in this mess alone together, and we all grow together. Well, I'm so impressed with what you're doing. It's exemplary to go out and pitch for a film like this, and I'm sure you're going to be successful. I think it'll be a wonderful show. So we'd love to hear from you again in the future and find out how you do and share your success with us. And so Claire and I sincerely thank you, Hollis, for sharing this. Just one more time, would you tell people how they can reach you?
Of course, and thank you very much. It's been a lovely opportunity to speak with you both. Yes, Hollis Rich Wright, W-R-I-T-E, at gmail.com.
Okay. Thank you so much. Lots of good luck, Hollis.
Well, thank you. I'd love to come back and tell you we got our show on the air. That would be great.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
That'd be fun. Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Claire.
You're welcome, and be well, everyone.
Thanks, Claire.
Okay.
You're welcome. Thank you, too.
Bye-bye.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice, fair use, successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.